So this discussion, so we have Parshas Truma begins the construction of the Mishkan. It's really wonderful. It's just full of colorful pictures and of all the different opinions as to how the tabernacle looked and its construction. And we'll go through a little bit of it. We'll study the menorah specifically this afternoon. And some of the different opinions as far as that goes. But if you see this lying around in your local Judaica bookstore, it's worthwhile because it's just fascinating. The artwork and the different opinions that are expressed throughout the commentaries, exactly how things went.
Of course, it's all on Hebrew.
Yeah, I just read the picture. I just look at the pictures myself.
The picture tells the story.
It is all in Hebrew, but... there probably are some in English as well. I would not be surprised at this point to find some that have very descriptive pictures.
What's the name?
It's called Mishkan Hashem. Okay. So before we get into some of the verses which describe the construction of the menorah, let's just start from the beginning of the Parshas on page 444. Parshas Teruma. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but just to give us the background as to where the context of where we are. So it's the end of last week's parasha, where the Jewish people have now had a whole parasha. We record the story of the giving of the Torah again. We've had a whole parasha of all the laws, many laws and parashas Mishpatim. And we have the command in the beginning of this week's parasha where Hashem tells Moshe to speak to the Jewish people. V'yikhu li truma. And verse 2 says, they shall take from me a portion. From every man whose heart motivates him shall you take my portion. So here you have the command to take a portion from the Jewish people, to donate part of their funds to the construction of the tabernacle. The sages derive, Rashi records this as well, that there were actually three separate trumos, three separate tithing is not really the word that I'm looking for, but giving of portions that were done. Two of them were half a shekel each. Every Jewish person gave the exact same amount, whether or not he was wealthy or destitute, whether or not he had a large family or a small family. Everyone gave a half a shekel, and they went for a specific task. Some went to build the base of the tabernacle walls. Some went to a public fund that would supply the animals for the sacrifices. And then there was an open donation, which people could give whatever they chose, however much they felt they wanted to give. And that fund went to the general materials and the functioning of the Mishkan. I've said over many times, I'm not sure if I did in this class last year or on other occasions, but that combination, very often we like to speak about different combinations. We have the standard tax. You have that element where everybody gives exactly the same. Everyone, doesn't matter, financial status, social status, it's just a half a shekel across the board. And then there is an opportunity for those who felt they wanted to give more. They were able to give more. They were able to express their thanks and gratitude by giving to the Mishkan or to the temple by giving more. So you had some of which were all even with, some of which you gave more. And all that was given to the construction of the tabernacle. The word teruma, by the way, teruma, which means, Rashi translated it to mean a portion. It's used a lot of times in the society of the agricultural society that the Jews lived in. When they lived in the land of Israel, truma was what you would give to the Kohen. You would take your crops and you would give him truma. Truma was a 50th or a 60th of your crops, and it went to the priest, and then following that you would take off a 10th and you would give what was known as miser to the Levi. So the word truma was used in that sense. The root of this word truma, which you give off a portion, comes from the word Rome, which means to exalt or lift up. So on a simple level, it's that you're lifting up the truma of the portion and you're consecrating it and saying, this was just the mundane, it was mine, and now as I separate it, I am giving it to a holier purpose. I'm giving it to the Kohen. I'm giving it to the tabernacle. I'm giving it to the Beis HaMikdash. And so it's raised up, its status is changed, and that's not just a nice thought. That's a real halachic concept. When a person, a Jew, separates a portion of his crops or of his money and says, this is Truma, this is for the Beis HaMikdash, this is for Tzedakah, that money takes on a status. If we're talking about crops, if a Jew would harvest his corn and take off an ear of corn and say, this is truma, if a regular Yisrael Jew, meaning a non-Kohen, were to eat it, that's a death penalty type of infraction. Once it's become truma, once it's been consecrated, it's a holy product. Same thing with these halachas are still applicable today when a person designates money for tzedakah. There are all sorts of laws which dictate, well, what happens if they don't need it anymore? What happens if a person makes a pledge to a shul or to a cause, and by the time they get around to paying it, they say, we don't really need the money, we've taken care of it, or the need doesn't exist. Well, what do you do with the money? These are theoretical questions. What do you do with the money? And it's a real question. It can't just go back into a regular fund. It's been designated for something. And it's always an issue in terms of a person designates money for a specific thing within a shul. They say, I want this to go to the rabbi's charity fund. And then, well, we needed it for pay for youth programming. Are you allowed to do that? There are laws which dictate once something has been separated and designated as any form of this truma, so then it has a special status. And there are laws which dictate what you can or can't do with it.
That's related to Shmita year when you buy anything now and they have to give you change back that
telling us not similar concept, but not related to Truma, it's related to the sanctity of Shmita products.
What if somebody makes a pledge and doesn't fulfill it?
You string them up.
That's a separate.
There's a physical lifting up.
If you didn't do it physically, yeah, say these dollar bills are the ones I'm getting.
With money, well, in other words, if it's just a bank account, then it's also there's money which is designated, but it's not a specific dollar because it's just something in the account. But this comes up a lot Purim time. Tomorrow will be Rosh Chodesh Adar. We have still 6 weeks till Purim because there are two others this year. But Purim, this issue comes up a lot where a person designates money for Matanos Lavionim. And then they want to know if they could use it for their meal, or if they're, let's say, I forgot. There are all sorts of laws that address once you have a concept of truma and it's been designated and separated for such a purpose. You know, I'm not speaking what is the actual practical, just to be aware that because it takes on a status. But I want to point out that Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, the great German leader of the German Jewry of the last century. So he writes that the concept of Rome, of exalting and lifting up, doesn't just apply to the money, but it's actually a reference to the person doing it. That when we are able to overcome all of our inherent desires not to want to do that, to take off a portion of our stuff and give it to something else, we are really exalting ourselves. We are really ourselves becoming raised up, so to speak, in our understanding of the reasons why we have our wealth and our understandings of our closeness to Hashem and what we're doing with our money. So the concept of teruma, which has all of that idea in terms of raising up the actual product or the money or the grain to be eaten by a Kohen. A Kohen, when he eats teruma, has to eat it in holiness. He has to be tahar. He's not allowed to be ritually impure. There are all sorts of laws which regulate that as well. And we raise up ourselves when we give truma, when we separate part of our money to be able to do that as well. Once we're on the topic, I'll just mention the concept that we do this today with our money, where we give what's known as miser, which is known as the tenth of our money. Part of that concept from this of specifically designating and exalting it is if a person needs to actually designate his miser money. He needs to designate, I'm giving a tenth of my money. So, for example, if a person, let's say, makes $100,000 a year, so they need to give $10,000 to charity, if they just happen to give $10,000 off of a running, they just have one bank account where everything goes into, and they just write out checks as the year goes on, at the end of the year they look back and they see, yeah, I gave over $10,000, they have fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah, but they have not fulfilled the concept of miser. Miser is specifically setting aside money as my miser. So that I get a paycheck and I set aside, and I either have a separate bank account or I have an accurate running ledger of what's going on. So I'm actually tithing. I have an account. This is my miser account. I've set up a separate bank account. Right away when I deposit a check, I can do everything online. It's so easy. You just transfer you know, 10% of the deposit that goes in, and I have a separate account and a separate checkbook, and this is my Meister account. This is where I have the tenth of my income, and it's a separate concept. There's a dispute whether or not it's a rabbinic mitzvah or a biblical mitzvah to give a tenth of our money. But whatever level of a mitzvah that it is, the concept of tithing, it needs to be a tithe. It needs to be a truma. It's separated, set aside, and this is my account from which I dispense my money.
Before taxes or after
taxes? It's post taxes. In other words, the halacha recognizes that taxed money is money which you never earned. It's not mine. So the government takes a portion of it, and you don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to pay miser. You don't have to give off a miser. It's not your. You didn't take that on. It's all part of like your expenses. And it's like a business. You know, like you don't take miser off your business. You don't take it off the net. You take it off the gross.
You
take it off the net. So that's part of the gross and the net. I have to pay taxes on it, but you never see that money.
In the computer age, it's fairly easy to figure all of this out. But in an agrarian society where you don't just have one harvest, so how did they deal with that setting aside at that point?
I think it's each harvest, whenever they would go out and bring things in from the field, is when it would have that obligation. But as you would take things from the field, the way that the phrase in the Torah is when you bring it into either a home or the silo, there's a certain stage when as it would go in there, that is now considered an entity, and that has to be tithed. There's certain stages, and that's a whole tractate exactly where that is, at what stage of the process it's tithed and given truma, but and more than this discussion today. Yeah.
That's a strange question, but. When you're in the field, they're taking food, and they're saying this is tzedakah, right? They're not taking money.
Yeah, there is the real concept is with food.
So if you have a restaurant, can you take food and say this is tzedakah, or are you still needing to do money?
I would imagine it's still money. Because you're not growing. If it's going to be in food, it's the stuff that you grew.
You could
donate. Any store is responsible for tithing 10% of its income. If you want to do that in food, there's a longer discussion. Maybe we'll talk about it. I would not have to maybe let's wait till after. It's exactly how that would work and when. And it depends when you look at the books. That's what, you know, how do you view the income? Separate discussion, yeah.
So if you just have your checking account and you give tzedakah when things come up, but at the end of the year you see you've given at least 10% or more, is that a problem?
So that's not a problem. You fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah, and you fulfilled it in a wonderful way. The concept of miser, there are two separate concepts. There's a concept of giving charity and tithing, giving a tenth of your income. So charity you've done, mitzvah tzedakah for sure, when you get up to Shemaim after 120 years, they will open up their arms and say, look at the ledgers and say, you've given a lot of tzedakah. Concept of miser, giving off a tenth, is a separate, again, it's a dispute whether that's a biblical command when it comes to money, or it's rabbinic, or it's just a custom. Whatever that concept is of a specific tenth, it would not have been fulfilled.
Okay, but this scenario I gave you, the person gave at least a check.
Right. No, so that's what I'm saying. In other words, the Torah says give tzedakah. And when a poor person comes to your door and he has a need, open up your hands and give to him. On that, there's no number affiliated with how much you give him whatever he needs. That's what the Torah demands of us. We have too many people who have too many needs, so we give them each one, we give them $36, $18, whatever we give them. That's because that's what there are too many, but otherwise, if this was the only person in the world who would come to me, whatever he needs, I would give him. There's no number, there's no 10th, 20th. That's the mitzvah of tzedakah. Somebody comes to you, has a need, open up your hand, give him something. That's tzedakah. There's another concept of taking a tenth of what you earned and designating it for another purpose, for holy purposes, a shul, charitable organizations, poor people, whatever. That's a separate concept than when somebody comes to my door, I give him something. This says, whatever I get, I have separated and said to Hashem, this part's yours. So even in the scenario that you've given me, at the end of the year, it turns out, look, I've given more than a tenth. That's fine. So you've given a lot of charity. You've never fulfilled the concept of whatever you've given me. I have separated a portion of it as soon as I get it and said, this is yours, not mine. I am now just the keeper of this, and I will dispense it as I see fit, but this is your money. It's not mine.
So you have to have two accounts.
That's the easiest way to do it. That's the most recommended way to do it is to have two accounts. Like, for example, when you want to give matanos le'avyonim on Purim time, you want to give one of the four mitzvahs of Purim is giving money to the poor. That money has to come from a non-miser account. You can't fulfill the mitzvah of Purim from your miser money. Because your miser money is not yours. Let's say you have two accounts. So as soon as I get in a paycheck, I separate money and I put that into my miser account. That's Hashem's money, that's not mine. I've already designated it as miser. So now I have a mitzvah to do on Purim of giving charity to the poor. I can't fulfill that with God's money. That's His money. I haven't given it out yet. But I need to then take from my regular account and fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah and say, from my regular account, I am going to give this money for this particular mitzvah of matanos le'avyonim. That's a mitzvah on me. Yeah.
Then what can you do with that? Who does that matzah money?
Yeah, so you want to give money to the shul, you can give money to a shul, you could pay shul dues with that money, because that's considered, you don't have to pay. There's a whole then discussion as to what can you give you, that's a huge topic, as to what can you give your ma'aser. Anytime somebody knocks on your door, that comes from your ma'aser money. If you want to pay, say there's a shul dinner. These are always the great, let's take some more simple cases. Can you pay for your children's tuition with your ma'aser money? The answer is no, because you have an obligation to educate your children, and therefore you can't take your Meiser money, which is a charity fund, and fulfill your obligation to educate your children. Let's say I have a neighbor who can't afford tuition, and I want to pay their tuition. That's totally okay. I'm allowed to take my Meiser money and pay for a friend's tuition. I can donate money to the school and say this is on behalf of so-and-so for their tuition, because I am donating now for my friend who can't afford it. I want to send money off, send money to Israel, people knock on my door, I get some yeshiva sends me a thing that they're all of that is totally fine to be used from your Maaser money. Tamima has a raffle. So can I buy a raffle ticket from Tamima? So it depends on the type of raffle. Most raffles where we'll sell as many tickets as we can, there's no specific number of tickets we'll sell. You can buy those tickets with your Maaser money. You want to buy 10 tickets? You could buy 10 tickets with your Tamima. If you want to take a look at them, here you have your raffle tickets. So they're selling them for $100. You're like, $100 a raffle ticket? Yeah, you could write that off of your Maaser account and say, this is a donation to Tamima.
Then are you expected to give 10% back if you win the raffle?
You're not expected to. The Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he has a tshuva about this, somebody asked him this question.
You're not allowed to do that.
Somebody asked him this to do a...
No. They'll give it all back.
Why? Oh, the school won't let you do it.
Because you're setting a precedent, and then anybody who wins in the future will feel like, well, I have to do that because last year so-and-so did that, so I'm not even going to buy one. I have to give it all back if I win.
Got it.
You can do it quietly, give it back.
Right. As long as no one knows about it. So Moshe Feinstein was asked the question about this. Can you use Meiser money to pay for these raffle tickets? So he writes, again, in the type of raffle where they're just selling it. If it's a type of raffle where it's like, we're only selling 100 tickets, then that's a different story, which I'll get to in a minute. But let's just say it's one of these kind of raffles. We'll sell as many as we can. So then he writes that you can use your Meiser money to buy those tickets. And he says if you win, it would be correct to give 10% of your winnings to that institution. You don't have to. That would be a correct place to give it. So you have a dinner. So the dinner is, $500 a plate. Phew, that's a hefty dinner. So... Right? It's in New York. You invited your cousins being honored in New York, and it's $500 a plate. $500 a plate. Yeah, that's what it costs. So, are you allowed to write that check off of Meiser?
Yeah.
So the answer is as follows. You have to deduct the value of your dinner, which is whatever it would be. Let's say it's a fancy dinner, so I don't know, $80, $90. You figure out how much, if I were to go out to a fancy restaurant, with the whatever it would be, if you figure out what they're paying for the caterer and for the hall, what it costs for them to feed me here, So say it's $100 a plate. So $100, you can't take that off of Meiser money. What's with the other $400? That's a donation to the institution. Everybody, that's how it works. The way they get $400 out of you is by charging you $500 and giving you a very fancy hotel and setup and meal. So the cost of the meal, you got to cover. But you could write $400 of that off of your Meiser money. So the same thing with a concert. Rick Goldberg is putting on a concert for Tamima. So how much is the value of going to the concert that I would go to hear that? So I paid $180 for that. Why did I pay $180 for that? Because I want to make a donation to Tamima. I happen to enjoy going to. What would I pay for a concert? I would pay $36. I would go hear him for $36. That's the value of a ticket of 2 hours of hearing such a concert. So if I go, so for the $36, that I got to pay for, and then the other, whatever it is, I can write off my check. If I'm not going to the concert because I can't make it, or just because I want to support Rabbi Goldberg, I can write all $180 off of my Meiser account. It's a donation to Tamima.
I have two questions. Could you please write the word Meiser on the board?
Yeah.
So I can visually see it. And also, I have
probably no marker.
Yeah, there isn't. I have a pen. I will write it on a piece of paper.
There may be one.
I have heard that there were certain obligations that take priority before you start calculating the 10%. Is that incorrect?
No, that's correct. It just depends what we're talking about. Yeah, there are books and books that have been written on the laws of what you can give your Meiser for and what you can't and how you calculate it.
Would you calculate that 10% off?
Let's say I lost $10,000 on a real estate venture that I have in Florida, and I make my income is $60,000, and I lost some taxes. How do I figure out at the end of the year what am I paying for? There's a whole.
Okay.
These are a complicated set of laws in terms of being able to work through what are my. A person who has a very simple job, it gets a paycheck. That's great, like nice and easy. Whatever you deposit, post taxes, take off 10%, and you're.
I thought it was even then you still had a portion for your housing and for schooling your kids, and then you took 10%.
No, the obligation that you have, like living, that doesn't come off. Okay. Certain things, in other words, there's some fascinating halacha we'll get to in a second. Let's say a wife goes out to work. So business expenses are deducted. Let's say, I run a business, and the business brings in X amount of money, but we have to spend this amount, so that's all taken into account. At the end of the day, this is our net profit. So if a wife goes out to work and has to hire childcare, not schooling, the children are still before schooling, that's a business expense. In order to allow the wife to go out to work, we have to pay this amount, so that's a business expense. That would then be deducted from your total net. If you spent, $10,000 over the course of the year on childcare, again, it's not school, but childcare, so then that $10,000 comes off of what the wife earns in terms of your net profit as far as what needs to be taken away. So that goes into account.
You mentioned something about losing $10,000 in a business deal.
Yeah.
So if you separated the 10, say, all along, and then you lose at the end of the year, but you've already separated it, so...
No, that's a good question. I don't know. Technically speaking, because you lost it, you never had to separate it out in the first place.
But you didn't lose. You didn't know you were going to.
Right, that's what I mean. In other words, you were just taking off your pay. If there's two sources of incomes in the home, someone's getting a paycheck, and then you have this business venture. So as the years goes on, you're separating from the paycheck, and then all of a sudden you find at the end of the year you lost the $10,000 on the business venture. I don't know if you could take it back out. That's I don't know. Technically speaking, you would be maybe. I don't know. I'm not well versed enough on that particular kind of question. In Hebrew, the word ma'aser is spelled as follows. I'm going to write in script, and I'm going to have to... I never write outside of script, so... it's going to come out sort of funny. My kids come home from school, and I can't write for them until they learn. Does that make sense? All right, ma'aser? In English, it would look like this. Manasseh. So the concept, the way, just once we're spending the whole day talking about this, the concept of Meiser is, the original concept again was when there's a farmer who grows crops, so he takes off two series, really three, from his crops. He has 100 bushels of grain, whatever it is that he takes in. First he gives to the Kohen Truma. So the Truma is about, there are three different ways. He could either 1/40th, 1/50th, or 1/60th of what he has, which is not a whole lot. From his grain. So let's take a simpler number. Let's say he has 60, he brings in 60 bushels of grain from his fields. So he takes off one of those bushels, one out of the 60, and he gives that to the Kohen, and that's known as Truma. That Truma has an exalted status. It is prohibited with punishment of death if any non-Kohen were to eat it once it's designated as Truma. The Kohen must eat his Truma in a state of spiritual purity. He must immerse himself. This is where, by the way, do you know why we wash our hands before we eat bread? Because when a Kohen eats Truma, so he needs to be in a state of ritual purity. So there are some minor forms of impurity, of Tuma, which can be taken care of simply by washing the hands in the way that we do it. So since the staple of Truma was grain and flour, the most common product that was produced from Truma was bread. A Kohen would almost always be washing his hands before eating bread, because he was not allowed, almost all of his bread came from Truma, that's how they got their food. So the Kohen's bread was almost always Truma bread. The Kohen would therefore always be washing his hands before eating his bread, because he, as a Kohen eating Truma, had to be in a state of ritual purity, which was always at least required to wash his hands. If he were to eat non-Truma bread, he wouldn't have to, and the Jews never had to do that, regular Yisraelim Jews. So the sages enacted, in order that we should always remember that there was once a concept called Truma, and that when you ate Truma, you had to eat in a state of ritual purity, and the most common form of Truma was bread, they said, not only should the Kohanim eat bread with washing their hands first, all Jews should take it upon themselves to wash their hands before eating bread, so that they'll remember the Beis HaMikdash should be rebuilt, we should return to the land of Israel, and we should all become farmers, and we should give the Kohanim Truma from our crops, and when the Kohanim will eat Truma, they will wash their hands before doing so, and therefore we do so, that should be perpetuated, that concept, and we're always reminded of that idea as we go along, and that's why we wash our hands before we bread. And so we wash our hands before we bread, because when the Kohanim ate this Truma, they had to do that in order to maintain their state of purity before eating it. A Kohen who had just buried his relative, or had come into contact with a corpse of any level, was prohibited from eating Truma. He was not allowed to eat Truma in that state.
I wonder why that didn't spread to the Israelis, having to wash hands before davening, because the Kohanim, for instance, in Sephardi,
Did spread. You have to wash your hands before you daven.
You have to do like
not in the same formal, because it was for the Kohen also. It wasn't, the Kohen was a little bit more formal. You don't have to do that. You just have to wash your hands, have to be clean.
Right, I know that, but I'm just wondering why it didn't be exactly.
I don't know. It's a good question. I guess maybe we see from the fact of how poorly we're able to even fulfill the simple just getting our hands wet before davening. Sages said, let's just get them into shul and forget about it. I don't know if that's exactly why, but you're right. That never was enacted by the sages, that level of washing before davening. Okay, so we started our class now, right? Recently. Get started. Okay, if there are any further questions, I would be happy you could email them to me or call me about the concept of Meiser. And you know what? I'm supposed to be choosing a topic for my Wednesday night halacha class, which I haven't as of yet done. Maybe we'll do Meiser. Maybe we'll go through some of the laws of giving Meiser. That be of interest?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do that. All the good ideas that are born out of this wonderful group. Okay, so in any case, this parasha basically begins again with the idea of Truma. Hashem asks of the Jewish people to take for me your Truma. And the idea that I had wanted to share, which is why I went here, didn't go straight to Menorah, is because 40 minutes ago, the opening line is "Vayikhu li truma," take for me truma. That's what Hashem says to the Jewish people: take for me truma, which is a funny way of saying it, because really he should have said, give to me your truma. But instead, the way that the Torah describes it is, take for me truma. It's not give to me, but take for me. And a lot of the commentators make mention of that really what we're doing is, when we give, really we're the ones who are taking. We're the ones who are gaining. So not to look at it as a giving of truma, that's what it feels to us when somebody knocks on our door and we're in the middle of doing whatever else it was that we were doing, that we are the ones giving of ourselves. Really, what in the big picture of life, what we're doing is we are the takers in this interaction, because we're the ones who are gaining. We're the ones who are working on all of our own issues of becoming more giving people, working through all the reasons why we don't want to give, why we want to hoard everything that we have for ourselves and close ourselves off from those who are more needy than ourselves. And therefore, a lot of the commentators make mention of that phrase, give, take for me your truma. Meaning you're the ones who are taking in this relationship. You're the ones who are gaining. You're the ones who are growing and are developing in that idea. That's all that I really wanted to say, and we just we got a little bit sidetracked. Okay, let's at least talk a little bit about the menorah. That's what I wanted to talk about. Okay, so what happens is in the parsha, so as you see, we begin with the concept of the Mishkan, a resting point, a focus, so to speak, for Hashem's presence that the Jewish people would be able to rally around. And then we have the parsha goes through the different ideas that we are commanded to build. You have the ark, we have the cover to the ark, and then you have the shulchan, the table, which had the showbreads. The 12 loaves of bread which were on there. You see a picture of that on the bottom of page 449. And then you have the menorah. So it's really the third vessel that's described in the parasha. First you have the aron which housed the luchos, the tablets that Moshe himself brought down from Har Sinai. We have that commandment. Then we have the shulchan, the table and the showbreads, that commandment the second. And then third you have the commandment to build the menorah. Now, the menorah was a fascinating structure. It's on page 450. There's a small little picture on the bottom of 451, and that's why I bought our little picture book, so that we wouldn't be limited to this little picture, and hopefully maybe I'll have a chance to pass it around, and you can take a look at some, test it or not. It's a Hebrew book, so it goes from right to left. You'll see almost every picture has a couple of different versions of the picture, and that is because this book is trying to express the different opinions that there are amongst the commentators as to how it looked. And what they did is they took the words that the commentators wrote and put it into what it would look like if it were actually to be constructed. And you could just flip through it quickly. You can see what the menorah looked like. Maybe take a look at it two at a time and try to listen. Look while I continue speaking, or just look at the pictures. Either way is fine. So the Torah begins in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 31 on page 451. V'asisa menorath zahav tahor. You will make a menorah of pure gold. Miksha te'aseh ha-menorah. Hammered out shall the menorah be made. That's a key phrase. Miksha te'aseh ha-menorah. You have to hammer it out. Yirecha v'kanag v'yeh kaftarehu fracha mimena. You know, the Torah gives a list of what its component parts are. You have the base. You have the shaft which comes out. You have the cups, knobs, and its blossoms. All are hammered out, and you'll see what these things look like. You can see a little bit on the bottom of your chumash, the knobs and the flowers and the cups. They have little pictures of it in much greater detail as that book is floating around. You will see. Now, the most prominent feature of the menorah is that word which I focused on a minute ago, miksha, that you hammer it out. So the sages understood from here that the menorah had to be made out of one solid piece of gold. As intricate as it is, and you will see that it is an intricate structure. You have all of these different components to it. You have the flowers and the cups and the knobs and the base and the six arms coming out from the center. All of that was hammered out from a single solid piece of gold. We'll get back to that part in a minute, but I do, as the book is going through, pay attention to the different parts, the knobs and the flowers and the bulbs, in its intricacy and the different decorations that it provided to the menorah. All of that hammered out, not each individual, which would have been the easy way to do that, have an individual series of knobs and flowers and bulbs, and then you just sort of connect them together. But instead what you have is separate pieces, but all carved out of the same solid piece of gold. I just saw this morning, I saw really a magnificent idea on that concept of intricate pieces being hammered out of a single piece of gold, that it really is indicative of the nature of the Jewish people, that we are so disparate, we are so unique and so individualistic, each person in the Jewish people contributing his and or her characteristics, talents, thoughts, mind to the Jewish people, and yet at the same time, we have to be all hammered out of a single piece of gold, one unit, not separate pieces glued together, hammered and nailed in together, but literally all out of the same solid piece of gold that we hammer out all the distinct and separate parts. And it's really, it's trying to show us the difficult task that we have and that we have heretofore not really successfully navigated of being individuals, separate and together. And it's what being part of Kol Yisrael is all about, and it's a difficult task. Moshe, we will see, wasn't able to figure out how to do this, by the way, with the menorah. We'll see, it's not an easy thing, how to be able to manage such a concept. But that's just one of the ideas that we have in this. Let's just read a little bit more, and then we'll talk about one or two concepts, what the menorah stood for. So you have the Shisha Kanim Yotzim Mitzida, verse 32. six branches emerged from its side. Three on this one side, and three on the other side. Just for the sake of, since we're running out of time, we'll just quickly run through some of the verses in English. You have the three cups, verse 33, engraved like almonds on the three branches of the menorah from its second side. And you see that on the top half of each one of the seven branches, you have the three cups. And then from those three cups, you have a knob and then a flower on top of that. And then on top of that, you actually have the cup where the oil would sit and that the menorah would be lit. Another prominent feature of the menorah, as is described on verse 37, the top of page 453.
But this, the shamash is not higher.
Correct, the shamash is not higher. Anyone know why that is?
Do we really have a shamash?
Correct, exactly. It's actually not a shamash. In other words, the concept of the shamash, our Hanukkah, our menorah that we light on Hanukkah time, is an eight-branched menorah. And it's eight branches, of course, because it's an eight-day miracle, eight-day holiday. Because the lights of the menorah in our home are not for our personal use, as opposed to our Shabbos candles, which are, but the menorah that we light in our home is not for our personal use. So so when the sages enacted the mitzvah of Hanukkah, they wanted to make sure that you didn't benefit from the light. And the way that they did that is they said, add a ninth light, and that will serve as a shamish, which is permissible to you, because it's not one of the eight designated lights of Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. And that, distinguish it, make it higher or separate from your menorah, so that if you were to accidentally get light from your menorah, again, you have to remember, this sounds almost funny to us because we have electricity, but for 99% of the life of the Hanukkah mitzvah that we have, there wasn't electricity. So you had candles in your house. That's what you used for light. And you regularly would use those candles to help you see, which you weren't allowed to do in Hanukkah. So they said, if you end up benefiting from your, at least you'll have the shamash, and we'll say, really, you were getting the light from the shamash, and that's why it's set aside. But in the Beis HaMikdash, there were seven lights. They were all equal, similar lights. There were no branches that were higher than any of the others. And you should know also, by the way, it's prohibited from making a seven-branch menorah. This is a vessel in the Beis HaMikdash, and it's only in the Beis HaMikdash that you have the seven branches. All other menorahs that you'll see are not seven branches. You'll pay attention in shuls. Many, many shuls have a menorah in the front to give light. And you'll see it's usually six branches. It's just three on both sides. They don't have the middle stem because we don't make seven-branch menorahs. We make either eight, which is what we do for lighting the Hanukkah candle, or six. But seven is designated for the Beis HaMikdash. And that's why none of them are higher. That's correct. They are all equal except... They are equal, except with what the verses, what we're about to read now in 29 says, I'm sorry, I flipped back a page. I meant 37. And Lamed Zayin. Vasisas Nero Seha Shiva. You make its branches seven. Ve'he'elos Nero Seha Ve'heyir Al Ever Paneha. You kindle its lamps so as to give light towards its face. Maybe you noticed in the book, and I think you could see it a little bit in the picture that we have here in the bottom of page 451. No, you can't see it at all there. But maybe if you notice, as the book was floating around, all of the lamps are kindled as follows, where the three on the sides are facing the middle, and the light in the middle is directly, that wick is up in the middle, and all the three branches, the wicks are facing the sides. So all the light points towards the middle. Many of the commentators have what to say on this as well. Sfarno is one of them, when he points out that the right-hand side of the menorah, those three branches, are representative of our maisim, of our handiwork, and the left side, the three branches, are for our Torah learning and our intellect, and whatever it is, be it the intellect, be it the maisi yadayim, the handiwork of our hands, all of it has to be directed towards the center light, towards that which is representative of the concept of a divine service, of our doing everything in focus towards Hashem. So whatever it is that we're doing, whether it's our learning or our working, that's fine, but it always has to be directed towards the center. And when the Jewish people, with all that we do in our own different and separate ways, are focused on the same idea, the same concept, so then everything works out for our favor. That's one of the ideas of the Menorah as well, is being a directed towards the middle. We could be on separate sides of that equation, but if we're all focused on the middle and directing our attention, that is the way that the menorah needs to symbolize is what we do. Now, lastly, before we run out of time, I just want to Rashi comments here based on the words of the Medrash that Moshe couldn't figure out how to do this menorah. Couldn't figure out. The word that the Torah used is in the beginning of Lamed Aleph, that it te'aseh. That it should be made. The sages saw in that word, it should have said, you shall make it. But in the fact that it said, it shall be made, so the sages of the Moshe couldn't figure out how to, it's an intricate structure. It's got its base and the pole and the three things and the different flowers and knobs and bulbs, and it's all coming out of one solid piece of gold. Moshe threw up his hands and said he couldn't figure out how to do it. So the sages say that Hashem showed him an image, a fiery image, of what the menorah needed to look like. So he had a vision. You need to see it on the board. I need to see what it looked like, right? So he showed him a picture on the board. This is what it looks like. So once he gets to work and he can't do it. Still wasn't able to do it. So the Medrash says that they threw the solid piece of gold into a fire, and out from that on its own came the menorah. So the morale asks the obvious question. The morale asks the funny thing. When he couldn't do it the first time, so he showed him a picture of it. So obviously he showed him a picture of it. That means Hashem understood from that Moshe should be able, he was showing it for him to be able to do. I wouldn't show you a picture of what I want, tell you to do it, if I know that you can't do it. And even after that, he still wasn't able to do it. And still the whole thing happened miraculously, where it was sort of done on its own. So why do I show him what I wanted him to do anyway, if he still wasn't able to do it, and the whole thing came out through a miraculous divine intervention anyway? So the morale puts forward the idea, which he brings from many other places, and we're going to do very quickly because we're running out of time, that even when Hashem does miraculous events, it is always done through the hands of man. It's always done in a way where he says, this is what I want, go for it. And we get started, we roll up our sleeves, and we begin the process, but it's impossible. We're unable to do it. But there's still that partnership in which Hashem says, I don't want you sitting back on your couch and I'm just going to do it for you. I want you to get down here on the floor with me and let's get started. Let's make it happen. If you can't do it, I'll be happy to finish off the process. But it's always that I'm not just going to have you sit back and watch and have me do everything. Man's involvement always needs to be there. It needs to be where we begin the process. And I'll bring this example of Kriyas Yam Suf, where Moshe was involved in the splitting of the sea with his staff, and the Jewish people went in up to their noses first, and all of the 10 plagues were brought about through somehow man's intervention bringing it on. And there's a partnership between man and God. And then even when it is miraculous events that are taking place in front of us, And it's done in a way where man has an active role. And even if it's a task that we're not able to complete, then it's impossible for us to complete, then it's beyond our capabilities, we get started anyway. And if you go through our own personal lives and communities' lives in Jewish history, it's always been, when you look back at things that the Jewish people have done, you say, how in the world did they get that done? That's just, it's beyond what could possibly have happened. And very often that's true, it is. That any particular event could have been done. But, you know, that's how we do it. You roll up our sleeves, and we get started, and before you know it, look what happened. Not always as openly miraculous as the incident of the splitting of the sea or the menorah's construction, but when you stop and look back and say, how did that happen? It is that same concept in which you get started and you begin a process and you start it, when you give it everything you have, somehow the help will come. But if you don't get started, it doesn't happen on its own. And I'll put that forth, one of the lessons here of the menorah as to how these incidents take place as well. All right, those are some thoughts on some brief thoughts on the menorah, some thoughts on Meisr, on giving truma and part of our income to tzedakah. And if there are other questions, again, I'm happy to address whatever I can as best I can. Okay.